So we are reading in chapter 21, and I began verse 22. It came to pass at that time that Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, spoke to Abraham, saying, God is with you in all that you do. Now, therefore, swear to me by God that you will not deal falsely with me, with my offspring, or with my posterity, but that according to the kindness that I have done to you, you will do to me and to the land in which you have dwelt. And Abraham said, I will swear. Then Abraham rebuked Abimelech because of a well of water which Abimelech's servants had seized. And Abimelech said, I do not know who has done this thing. You did not tell me, nor had I heard of it until today. So Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and the two of them made a covenant. And Abraham set seven ewe lambs of the flock by themselves. Then Abimelech asked Abraham, what is the meaning of these seven ewe lambs which you have set by themselves? And he said, you will take these seven ewe lambs from my hand, that they may be my witness that I have dug this well. Therefore he called that place Beersheba, because the two of them swore an oath there. Thus they made a covenant at Beersheba. So Abimelech rose with Phicol, the commander of his army. They returned to the land of the Philistines. Then Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba, and there called on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham stayed in the land of the Philistines many days. So, looking at these first verses that are up on the board, 22 to 24, we see one section. And we might just, again, let's just practice. In narratives, you always want to figure out the who's. So who's who in this one? What who's do you see? Abimelech. Phicol. Abraham. God.
Posterity.
Offspring. Okay. I think that covers those names that, you know, a lot of times you'll find with these narratives, the kind of in the first paragraph or so, here's the cast of characters. Now we'll see them coming in and out of the play depending on as the narrative continues. Let's see, I think I got them all this time. Abimelech, Phicol, Abraham, God, my offspring, my posterity. Okay, so far, so good. I might ask you quickly, what do we know about, have we ever met Phicol before?
Yeah.
No. What's his? What does he do?
Commanded
the army. And so with that, we. What is it? So who is showing up to talk to Abraham then?
King.
A king. And the what would that be in our category? Would that be the chief of staff, like the commander of one of the army branches? This is the giant, the head of the Secretary of Defense. Would that be kind of, but he's more of a military guy, not a civilian. So that's kind of important. That's kind of a significant, isn't it? Maybe in your work of employment, your manager comes by with a police officer to talk to you. What starts going through your mind? What did I do? Where did I park my car? You know, you start thinking, what could possibly be going on here? But in other words, this is kind of a forceful showing, isn't it? Okay, that would catch your attention. This isn't just a small thing. And so they say, now therefore swear to me by God, you will not deal falsely with me, with my offspring, with my posterity.
Is that okay?
Pardon me?
Swear to me by God. Is that okay?
You find, you can do it falsely. Can you swear by God? You do see, in fact, through the Old Testament law, where God will say, he sets up situations where that's how you can determine the veracity of someone's testimony, that they swear by God. So taking an oath in the name of the Lord is not in false in biblical thinking. But the problem in the Jewish world became that they, you know, you don't swear by the temple, but by the gold of the temple. You don't swear by the altar, but by the sacrifice offering. You know, it became kind of a, there were gradings of oaths, and some of that led to trickery. And Jesus said, let your yes be yes and your no, no. But for example, even Jesus, when the high priest says to him, I abjure you,
before the living God, or however he put it, speak the truth, that Jesus spoke. So in other words, he was put under oath and he spoke. So it's acceptable, but to take the name of the Lord in vain, often we think of that as using the Lord's name as a curse word. Most significantly, it would be to take an oath of, you know, before God, I say I'm telling the truth, and you're lying. That's taking the name of the Lord God in vain in a huge way. So in other words, they come to him, swear to me by God that you will not deal falsely with my offspring. Notice they begin by saying, God is with you in all that you do. That's a couple of Gentiles that are saying that. How did they know? Why would they say that God was with Abraham? How did they know? And that reminds me of something that one of my professors at Dallas Seminary told us. He loved humor that was about graduates of a particular institution, educational institution here in Texas. In light of the fact that I wouldn't want to be considered accused of being discriminatory, I will eliminate that reference. But he would often begin his lectures with, say, Dr. Honer, chairman of doctoral studies, chairman of the New Testament department. Often he'd begin his lectures with one of these jokes, or use them as illustrations. And he told this as an illustration. One thing he was talking about, how Bible critics will say, Jesus said this, but he didn't say that. And he said, how do they know? And he talked about, and I'll change the story just slightly. A teenager, you can translate that if you need to, a teenager was given a birthday gift of a thermos bottle. His friend told him it was an amazing invention. If you put in a hot liquid comes out. If you put in cold liquid comes out. Put in hot, it keeps it hot. Put in cold, it keeps it cold. And the teenager, his eyes widened and he was shocked. How does it know? You know, to give you hot or cold. You know, how does it know which one to give you? And so I think of that. And so here's the question I'm asking you. How did they know that Abraham was blessed with God? They said, God is with you, Abraham. Why would they say that?
Because it's the same with Abimelech.
I think so. This is within a short period. It's in the same chapter of the birth. And so, yes, I'd say it's the same Abimelech in this case, probably.
So he'd already had God telling him, you die if you sleep with my wife.
Wouldn't that get your attention? Mm-hmm. You're a dead man. What? You took this man's wife, and he's the only one who can pray, and you will survive. He's my prophet. Okay, so one, God told him, he's my prophet. Okay, so God is with you. He protected you. Can you think of any other evidence they might notice? Yes, Steve.
Well, God spoke to him in a dream.
God spoke to Abimelech. You don't get a stronger testimony. Yes. Were you?
His wealth and flocks and...
He's prospered. Remember, I'm reminded of Joseph. Remember when, I guess it would have been Potiphar who said, God is with you. Or maybe it was the head of the prison. But God is with you. Anything you do prospers. So I'm going to put you in charge of my stuff. God's blessing works for me then. So, yeah, they looked at the prosperity. Look at this. You're fabulously wealthy. In fact, I've been thinking about this. How many... servants, do you remember how many servants went with Abraham that were born in his house that went with him against those four kings? 300 318 or 72 in the 300s. And so we started, those are the ones born, those would be males of fighting age. And so what we're saying is there must have surely at least three times that would be his servants, maybe four. So we said maybe a team of 1,000 servants. Vast herd, and so, I mean, that's starting to get like a small nation. I mean, that as far as Gerar is a city-state, it's, you know, probably bigger than that, but he's a force to contend with, and more than that, God is with him.
Maybe okay. Joel Osteen is right.
Yeah, you know, I think, yeah, some of the prosperity gospel, they'll grab on some of these verses and say, yeah, there you go.
Well, that's all well and good, too. I understand that. But wouldn't it be just because of the fact that his wife was pregnant and they had a baby?
There's another one. He's talking to an 800-year-old. An 800.
a 100-year-old man with a 90-year-old wife, and she's with child. You're amazing. Look at your flocks. Look at your household. God himself speaks to me in dreams about you. Here's this. Wow, God is with you. So the next thing he says is, we ask you that you swear, take an oath that you will not deal falsely with me. Why did he do that?
He's already done
it. Yeah! I know you're a man of God and God's with you, but you're a liar. You know, isn't that a horrible testimony? So they ask for an oath because...
You're a rascal.
Yeah, that would be a good Hebrew expression. You're a rascal. You know, you have tricked us before, so if you're going to tell us something, I want a clear out oath, and here's what we're going to say, okay? Okay, I think so. And by the way, that incident is still probably stinging for Abimelech. You are dead. Your whole household, dead. There'll be not a child or an animal born unless you get this right with Abraham. Boy, that got him thinking. And the whole time he's thinking, but he lied to me. So he comes to him and says, I want you to take an oath. Okay? Good. Okay, so he says, I'll do it. But then Abraham rebuked Abimelech because of a well of water which Abimelech's servants had seized. And Abimelech basically does everything he can say, I know nothing. Who comes to mind here? Yeah, Sergeant Schultz, you can show your age. I know nothing about this. Did he know nothing? I'm not so sure. Maybe he knew. Maybe he didn't. I don't know who's done it. You didn't tell me. You know, you've never filed a complaint with me. I know. This is the first I've heard of it. Yeah. Yeah, could be. Is this two scoundrels dealing with each other? Maybe. And so Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and the two of them made a covenant. Let's look for a minute at here's a picture of a well that's traditionally thought to be Abraham's well, perhaps, but it's in the area of near the city of Beersheba. And there's another picture. Anything strike you about these pictures about that well?
It's hot.
It looks hot, yeah. It
looks
is hot.
Like concrete in there.
Looks like concrete.
Dry all around it.
Yeah, it's dry. You can see why.
It doesn't have big sides. It's like you could fall right in.
Yeah, okay. It's not built up around. Do you notice these things here? The lines all along? What do you think that is? That's exactly right. This is kind of a soft stone. You see the fellow with the rope there? After centuries of pulling up water by rope, there are all these grooves, deep grooves in the stone all along. So there's something of the well. So here's a question for you. Why raise the issue of the well seizure now? There's no better time to bargain, isn't it? I mean, while we're at the table, while we're talking about commitments, you want a peace treaty, what better time to say, because we do have a problem. Now, is he being petty about this well issue?
No, water's...
Water is life.
Yeah.
Water rights are very important. And if you don't believe that, on Saturday mornings, watch some westerns that are on, and you'll see some kind of a gunfight over a water fight somewhere in there. You know, the sheep are taking the water that's supposed to be for the cows, or vice versa. Water rights in Israel. It's an ongoing strife between, for example, like with Israel and Jordan, Lebanon. You know, if someone's taking the water out of the Jordan, who's getting it? Water rights are a big deal. Water rights are an essential thing in America. Californians and the folks in Colorado dispute who has the rights to water because, especially in an agricultural environment, if you don't have water, you have no business. And he's in the animal husbandry business side of agriculture, water is everything. And so he had this, he found the water source, they dug the well, and Abimelech's people stole it. And so he's saying, if you want peace, we have to deal with this issue, right?
Maybe there's some pride here too. You accuse me and I'll hit back at you.
Yeah, there's a good point. Spoken like a husband. While you're criticizing me, let me remind you, you had this failing. actually, this is an effective bargaining tool. While you're reminding me of my failed integrity, you guys have done me bad. You've robbed from me. The Hebrew word for seized is, you can use it of robbery. They seized it. Interesting, he didn't choose to go to war over it. I mean, he could have, but here's his opportunity to settle while we are negotiating a peace treaty, a peace covenant. This is a great time to say, let's settle the issue of water rights.
Was it settled, though? Because Abimelech didn't say, okay, it's yours.
Well, notice what he does. So, Abraham takes sheep and oxen and gives them, and the two of them made a covenant. And so that exchange of the money is a kind of way of sealing the deal. And so, it's one of those things, you cash the check, the contract is good. He gave him the gift by receiving it. He was acknowledging that's your well. It's not really purchasing it. But it's a covenantal way of saying, okay, I took this gift, we're good. Like when he gave the gift about Sarah, we're good. You accepted the gift, there's no claims against each other, we are settled. So that's the spirit of what's happening here. So that's what was going on with the animal exchange. Okay. Now the narrative kind of continues with this next one. So Abraham sent 7 ewe lambs of the flock by themselves. And so they're having all this. And all of a sudden, and maybe it was done very dramatically, I don't know. Here's all these sheep. Here's the oxen I'm giving you. But there's those 7 sheep that are over there separately. And so Abimelech asks, what's the meaning of these 7 ewe lambs which you have set by themselves? And he said, you'll take these 7 ewe lambs from my hand. They may be my witness that I have dug this well. Therefore, they called the place Beersheba because the two of them swore an oath there.
Okay.
And they made a covenant at Beersheba. Now, I've done something here to help you. This is one of those times where it really helps to know the language. Okay? The word for 7 is Sheba. The word for oath is Sheba. Do you notice that? It's spelled and pronounced the same. So this is the technical way you would transliterate that. You see the 7, 7, 7, and they swore an oath is built on this word. You can see the same letters basically as Sheva. They swore an oath there. And therefore it's called the well, Be'er Sheva, the well of the 7, or the well of the oath. And so he set aside the 7 because that represents an oath. It's a play on the word. And so some of our words, we have words that sound the same, like red. There's a red barn and I read the book. Well, here are two words that look and sound the same, but have different meanings. And so he played on that and said, you will take these 7, these Sheva lambs to remind you of the Sheva that we have agreed to today. And therefore they called it the well of the Sheva, the well of the 7, the well of the oath. Now you can go to Beersheba today. And I think I showed you pictures last time. I did. Let me go back.
What language were they speaking?
Good question. It's very much like Hebrew probably, or Canaanite, is very similar to Hebrew. you may have heard me at times mention a language called Ugaritic, and that's a Canaanite language, very close to Hebrew, and so they would have been, and Aramaic is very similar as well, so that's probably, they were in that language, I'm guessing. So here's Beersheba, the wall. Here is the excavated city of to the left. But there you see a well. There's modern, I guess, Beersheba over there. And but that's, you know, there's a water source that's determined by Beersheba. And so the city. But
is there still water in that well?
I don't know. I know when I went to the well in Shechem, where Jesus sat with the lady, you can get a drink of water out of that well. So he does a play on word. Now, here's an interesting passage. Here's an encounter. We've walked through some of the details. Maybe you've noticed some other things. Now I'd like to ask some of these why questions. Why is this passage in here? And here's the question. What does this teach the Israelites on their way to enter the land? Okay, Moses is writing this for Israel as they're going into the land. That's the primary audience. Why did he include this story? What are they supposed to gain from that?
It teaches them how to deal with the people that they encounter.
Okay, there's some instruction here on dealing with the people of the land. Gerar is part of an area we call Philistines, though the ethnic Philistines don't actually come until later, but we still call this group Philistines as well. But yeah, so part of this maybe as you're dealing with the people of the land, especially some of the people you're to destroy, but what about the neighboring areas as this Gerar is, what do you do with that? Okay, so cautious, peaceful negotiation. Good. What else?
Did Abraham lay claim to it with a well and a tamarisk tree?
Well, in laying claim, this is a laying claim. So this is kind of a foothold. And so one of the things, when you go to Israel, what's kind of things kind of exciting is you can go to these places. You know, which well is actually the well, and you can go and there's a tree there. I'm not going to guarantee that that's the one he planted. But if you look carefully, there's this little heart that says A and S. I'm not just saying it. But what's interesting, you go to the Garden of Gethsemane, and the olive trees there could easily be 1,200, 1,500 years old or older. Amazing. But anyway, but they can go to the area of Beersheba. They can see what they would have been able to see, probably the well. And that would just be a reminder of Abraham, our forefather. You know, this was his property. This, you know, that's a reminder that they have a claim on the land. Good. What else? One of the things I'm not so sure what to think about in chapter 26, Isaac's going to go to Gerar, and he's going to deal with Abimelech. And yes, Rebekah's going to be his sister. Okay, here we go again. But in their interactions, there's going to be battles over several wells. And so does this kind of tell us, by the way, you made these great treaties with the Philistines of Gerar, and what do? That as soon as you turn around, they're stealing your wells again. Be careful in your dealings with the locals. Very possibly.
And should he have been making a covenant with them?
Should he have done that? What do you guys think? Why not? Or why?
Wasn't it more like a political thing? Basically, this is my will. So there's nothing spiritual about it, right?
True. Yeah, that's true. There's nothing. This is not a spiritual unity. Mark, let's try to say something.
Oh,
yes.
A
You were scratching your head, or were you going to bid on that couch?
Well, later, weren't they cautioned not to make agreements because when those other nations get in now the source of God, then they're bound by the agreements.
When they come in 400 years later, God says, don't make agreements with them. You're to destroy them. Don't make treaties. So is this an indication? I'm inclined to think this is kind of a just a cooperative land deal in a sense, settling water rights and just saying we're not going to be in conflict with each other at this point. Seems like he had that with Mamre. You remember the Oaks of Mamre, so they could even go to battle together.
Well, maybe God's even using this to, I mean, in the first half of the chapter, basically, God uses the Gentile to set Abraham straight, and then maybe he uses this to kind of take the Gentile back down a notch so he doesn't think he has dominion over Abraham.
That's good. So in other words, this kind of again shows us, puts a fuller picture on the relationship with these Gentile neighbors. Yeah. Okay, good. So that's but that's the question we should be, don't ever forget. Have you ever heard all this talk about judicial nominees and justices and all that? One of the expressions sometimes you hear is an originalist. Have you heard that expression? An originalist is saying, what did it mean when it was written? I'm an originalist for our founding documents, but also the Bible. First issue is, what did it mean when it was written? So that's the why. And one of the questions we're saying is, who was the audience? Moses wrote this, first of all, to the people going into the land, and then their descendants who will be in the land. But that's his first audience. And so to get the primary meaning, what did it mean in that context? Well, you know, that's where you look at the history, the grammar, and all that. What did it mean then? I heard a quote from this week from one of the congressional representatives from New York. And she's a freshman congresswoman from New York. And she was defining capitalism. And the person that was played the clip then flipped open Webster's dictionary, and there was a marked distinction between what she says capitalism to me means oppression. And then the dictionary was capitalism refers to an economic system built on principles of private property and competitive commerce. Well, but in other words, you can't, one of the problems is when we just redefine terms and say, what does it mean now? What did it mean when Moses wrote it? Okay, that's step one. Now again, here's the warning. We don't sit around in a circle, hold hands, sing Kumbaya, and then say, what does it mean to you? What does it mean? But then now there are applications that can be multiplied, right? Okay, what if this looks like in my marriage, just like this and whatever. Okay, so that leads to my next question. What does this passage teach us? And so we spent some time, okay, some warnings in there. And I'm not, and I'd be very interested in any thoughts you do have. Are there applications that we should be deriving from this chapter? Because the Holy Spirit wrote this through Moses. In the New Testament, Paul says these Old Testament passages are for our benefit. We are to learn from them. What goodies do you get? Does anything jump out at you, or is this something you're going to have to think about and listen carefully on Sunday? Does anything jump out at you as what does this have to do with us? I know wells can be a deep subject.
I can still think about it. The grace of God is, I mean, here comes Abimelech, the king. He's got his army guy with him. I mean, he could have wiped Abraham out.
The grace of God that protected him. By the way, the other side of that is, the grace of God that, what did God say? I'm going to make you a great nation. He's kind of acting like he's having an international treaty there. Good. But God's protection. Here, this could have been war. And especially water rights.
Don't deal falsely.
Yeah, life is simpler, isn't it? If You know, because what did it say? The, one of the problems with telling a lie is then you have to constantly remember what your lie was. You know? And so life is so much simpler when you can deal with integrity. And frankly, honors, that's just, that's one application. It honor, it dishonors the Lord when we're known as a, someone God is with us and yet we lie and we have to, we're not trustworthy. It's a troubling thing sometimes that people make a point of using religion to manipulate people. They'll put a fish on their business card and think, oh, therefore you shouldn't ask me any questions. It's wonderful when you deal with a Christian who really does live his integrity. I remember early on when my first car, I'm not sure if it was a car or a boat, but it was on wheels, so it was a car. Anyway, had some problems. I took it to I asked the mechanic, if I bring this car in, what are you going to cost charge me to do this, fix this job? He said, I'll charge you this much. I brought in, he said, oh, I'm going to charge you this much. And I said, but you told me you would charge me this much. He looked at me and said, well, if that's what I told you I'd charge you, then that's what I'm going to charge you. So in other words, he was willing to stick by his word. And it meant nothing to him to, he didn't give a thought about that and wrestle with, but he said, if that's what I told you, I'm sticking by my word. I thought, I like this guy. I'm going to deal with this guy. Man of integrity. So may we be like that in all of our dealings. You know, what do you know the expression? As good as his word. You know, the old days, people would almost be upset if you asked them to put it in writing. What do you mean put it in writing? I just told you what I'm going to do. And there were people, that's all you needed. It doesn't matter how much we're talking about or what. Man, we should be known for our integrity. So it's a rebuke to us and it dishonors the Lord when it's different from God's people. And they have to ask for assurances. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't have contracts. We live in that world today, but so it should be. Yes?
Well, in 33, he planted the tree.
Yes.
And then called on the name of the Lord. So it seems like he was making a memorial or something to remind him of this, remind all of them of this treaty. And then he seemed to give it a stamp of approval with calling on God.
What's it say exactly in verse 33?
Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba and called there on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God.
The everlasting God. A tamarisk tree is an evergreen. And so it was meant to be a picture of the God who doesn't change. It's evergreen. Unless I'm the one responsible for watering it. Soon brown. But you get, and so he plants it by a well. Okay, so there's a water supply. And so that's how we know that must be a 4,000-year-old tree in that picture. But you're right. So he planted the tree. He called upon the name of the Lord. That's kind of synonymous with worship. So what do we glean from that? The closing verse of this chapter and of that episode is he plants the evergreen, calls upon the ever-living God in worship. Applications.
Maybe every time he looks at the tree, he'll remember God's.
So was he going to worship that tree?
No.
Now, could someone come along later and worship it? Maybe. Okay. Like, remember the serpent, the bronze serpent they put on a pole, look on this and be healed. Later on, it became an object of worship, and they said, okay, we destroy it. But as a symbol or as a memorial of God's grace, not at all a problem. And maybe there's a testimony for us. Sometimes it's good to plant a tree. Maybe not a tree, but in some way using a memorial, a concrete memorial of God's grace. By the way, in Israel, you can buy a tree, and they'll plant a tree in your name. We've got a tree just outside the kitchen out there of the church. That's a memorial to James McKnight, who was a faithful servant of the Lord, and who was just as sweet as magnolias. But all that to say, the benefit of using memorials to the Lord to remind us and be a picture of his faithfulness. Being careful, he didn't make a statue of God, but he made him, you know, so that might be a reminder and a practical testimony as well.
He worship God just for who he is, the eternal.
Yeah. Eternal God. With all this back and forth, God doesn't change. And so he worships the unchanging God. So yeah, the chapter closes with worship. And I think that's maybe an important testimony as well. This is one of those passages that's a little more challenging to think through. What are the implications for us today? And yet it's good to remember, okay, God, you put this in here. The scriptures have value. What are some lessons for us? And that might take a little more. Now, you got to be careful about, you know, that means I have to go plant a tree. I'm going to the nursery today. But what are some lessons I can glean from this? And what is it you want us to learn about you and that? And I think that's an interesting thing. It ends with God. You know, so we're talking about these, you know, international treaty, if you will. It ends focusing on the Lord. And that's, so that shows us where Abraham is coming in his life, where he's viewing his circumstances through the eyes of God. And it begins with the pagans, right, coming to him. Well, God is with you. And so Abraham's kind of giving God the glory.
Later on, when they'd entered the land, they were to put up monuments here and there.
Yeah. Remember when they crossed the Jordan River, they were supposed to leave 12 stones in the river, 12 stones outside the river, and intentionally meant to be like, you know, where kids would come along and say, you know, stones don't put themselves there. How did that get there? Well, let me tell you. Son, go count the stones. How many do you see? And so let's talk about it. There was a miracle. You see these 12 stones? Right inside the deep Jordan River, there's 12 stones to match them. We walk through there on dry ground. You know, so, yeah, memorials to God's grace. They were to write God's law out and have a big ceremony of reading the blessings and curses in the land. So the value of some of those kinds of things. Yes?
And his descendants could benefit from that well for themselves.
Yes, so that well became really was meant to be like a family heritage. Like I said, Isaac's going to have some problems with this same nation over wells in chapter 26. And we'll have to come back and keep this chapter in mind when we're looking at that and say, okay, what's going on here? But again, water rights are a key issue. And Abraham got his foothold in the land. Now, I don't know if you'd say he owns the land, but kind of has the water rights there. Vital for a shepherd. But later on, the only land he will actually own is the grave in Hebron, in the cave of Machpelah. That'll come up with the burial of Sarah later on.
I guess you could stretch a little bit and say for the price of the lands, you secured the water rights. Maybe it's kind of shaky analogy.
You can get a little spiritual and say, yeah, the water of life here. And water is, that's why Jesus said, drink. I'm going to give you a drink of water. You'll never grow thirsty. I mean, water is life. And so that is a perfect picture of spiritual life as well.